One thing the Buddha pointed out repeatedly, and which I feel is quite unique to the Buddha Dhamma, is the natural character of all the various meditations, the simile of the raft, that all the teachings he has given and all the meditation instructions are not meant to constitute the absolute truth or the final goal in itself, but they are only a technique, a tool, or a raft for crossing over. They are only meant to achieve a certain purpose, and that purpose is for the heart to let go. We could also say for the heart to experience nibbida, viraga, and vimutti, disenchantment, turning away, dispassion fading away, and liberation, release, freedom. So it's not so much point in arguing about the absolute truth of something the Buddha was teaching, but it's more the question whether that particular teaching does lead ultimately towards nibbida, viraga, and vimutti, towards letting go. For example, contemplating dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature of all conditioned phenomena. If one can also contemplate sukha, because it can give us a certain amount of happiness. Eating nice food, there's a pleasant feeling. Hanging out with loved ones, meeting loved ones is a pleasant feeling, and one could make an effort contemplating that instead. You can't really say oneness, absolute truth, contemplating dukkha, or contemplating the pleasant aspect of things. But what is the end result? And if we are contemplating the happiness we can get out of food, or the happiness we can get out of our body, the pleasant feelings, or the pleasant feelings, joy and happiness, loved ones and people we are attached to can provide us, that obviously doesn't lead to letting go. It will lead to stronger attachment, to more craving. And that is a problem. So it's a bit teleological, and it has a certain purpose. And that explains a lot. I'm not saying this is the only thing, but it's absolutely crucial. The craving, sometimes when you present that Four Noble Truths to people, particularly those who have not yet really worked with deeper aspects of the Dhamma much, and often Buddhism is represented as almost like starting with that, the first thing people hear. And the answer you often get, or the objection, that craving is also the source of happiness. Of course, no one can't deny that. If we can fulfill certain cravings, and it will give us a pleasant feeling. And which one you contemplate, in a sense, is one's choice. You can contemplate one or the other. And there's these two aspects to it. The question is, what is the outcome, what is the result? And if I contemplate whatever happiness craving sometimes can provide me, then it will increase craving, it will make it stronger, and I will not get out from craving, and I will not get out of samsara. On the other hand, if I contemplate how craving is inextricably tied up with the consequences of clinging, becoming, rebirth, old age, sickness, and death, and suffering, and then I can gradually wean the heart from craving, I can gradually reduce craving, and once the understanding is deep enough, then one can completely abandon craving in the heart. Talking about Four Noble Truths, we are already at dependent origination. widely known as a core teaching of the Buddha Dhamma, the insight that all the Buddhas have in the night of their supreme awakening. And it's quite fascinating how people can get into intellectual arguments, which exactly is a wide interpretation, and whether it's over three lives or not, or long-term or immediately or momentary, and what is the exact meaning of the different links. I'm sure it's important to, to try to understand the teaching the way the Buddha gave them with the intended meaning, no other than some distorted meaning based on modern conditioning, which we have picked up in our life beforehand. But the really important one is that it should lead to the letting go of all the links in that long chain, because all the links are chained to old age, sickness, death, pain, desperation, grief, depression, frustration, despair, suffering. And the whole point is that the mind then can see that this is a condition that leads ultimately to suffering, and that the mind then can let go. The real point of dependent origination, as I see it, is not so much any particular intellectual interpretation of the meaning in terms of notion, concept, sannyas, but the real point is to go to paticca-samuppada, patiloma, against the grain, that is the nirodha, the cessation mode. You can contemplate dependent origination, anuloma, as it says in Pali, and that is the arising mode. Imasmin sati idang huti, imasupada idang upachati. Now when this is, that is, with the arising of this, that arises. Now this is the origin of the whole world, the origin of the whole universe, the universe in a subjective sense, the universe of our conscious experience. And when there are, when there's ignorance and there are formations, with the formations there is consciousness. Consciousness is a condition for name and form. And there's name and form, and then you have the sixfold sense space. There's the eye faculty, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And the sixfold base is there. Then we will have sense contact. It cannot be avoided. Now, once you've got nama rupa, you've got the six sense organs, and then you will have sense contact. Once you have sense contact, there's always feeling. This is very simple. Imasmin sati idang huti. And when there's this, then there's also that. And this exists, now that exists. When this arises, when this comes into being, that comes into being as well. And if you have an ascension body, consciousness and ascension body, then you will have sense contact. And every sense contact inevitably means that there's feeling. It will always feel pleasant or unpleasant or sometimes neutral. It can be very unpleasant, painful, excruciating. It can be super pleasant, mind-blowingly nice. Anyway, it's all feeling, all vedana. When there's vedana, there's craving, because we want pleasant feeling and we don't want the unpleasant one. The strongest motivation for craving. Not the only one. It's not that this is the exclusive only condition and the exclusive only result. When you go through dependent origination, sometimes there could also be other conditioning factors and there could be other results, but this is a very important one, which are always there. Now, once you have got craving, then it will lead on to clinging, grasping, identification, the I, me, mind-making, Sakaya Ditti delusion, of self, you know, leading on to bhava, to becoming, being, becoming, existence, and then the birth. And once birth occurs, you know, then there will definitely be old age, sickness, death, pain, disappointment, frustration, depression, despair, suffering. This is the arising mode, anuloma in Pali. These things arising. When one is, the other is as well. When there is sense contact, there's always feeling. When there's consciousness, there's name and form, and so on. The one implies the other. When one arises, the other arises. When one comes into being, the other comes into being. Now, this is a point more, you know, to actually observe that. Of the observe that happening, it's not so much trying to spin off, you know, some proliferation of intellectual interpretation in terms of notions, terms, concepts, sannyas. How exactly you explain that intellectually? This is something which should be experienced in the heart, observed, occurring in the heart, and then in particular in the other mode of patiloma. Imasming asati idang nahuti, imasa nirodha idang nirochati. And when this is not, that is not. It's quite simple. There's actually no need to go into too much of intellectualization about that. When this is not, that is not. If you didn't have a body, would you have sense organs? Without a body, would you have an eye and ear and nose and so on? Probably not, no? So if the body is not there, nama-rupa, you wouldn't have the sense organs. If you didn't have any sense organs, would you have any sense contact? Obviously not, and so on. Each single link has this quality. However, the more important one is not just contemplating that on the level of sanya and thinking, but the crucial point is now experiencing the patiloma, experiencing it all going nibodha. Now this is understanding dependent origination as far as I'm would interpret it. Now this is a real understanding, that you actually have it going into nibodha. Understanding, real understanding of dependent origination implies, experience that it all goes into cessation. And obviously when it goes into cessation, then the state of freedom, the amata dhatu, is experienced. And when all conditioned phenomena cease, and that is the experience of the unconditioned, what's known as nibbana. This is understanding it, and write many articles about it and read many books and compare the different interpretations, but never getting to the state that actually does go into nirodha, will never lead. It's never what it's all really about. The whole teaching is about that. And the real understanding of dependent origination, the asatas, so to speak, the purpose, the point, is that it should lead to the experience of dependent origination, patiloma, against the grain, the cessation. So important not to get stuck too much in what is also known as papancha, in proliferation. This is never the point. The learning the Dhamma and having this concept in one's mind should always support the ultimate goal, that the heart can let go. If it becomes a point of contention and we argue with others about the exact interpretation of dependent origination, and then we get attached to our interpretation and we dislike the other one, we experience anger and enmity and so on, that is obviously going a completely wrong direction. That's what the Buddha said, in holding the snake on the wrong end, and grasping the snake at the tail, and it bites you. Now I can grasp at the Dhamma in an unskillful way. In reality, you know, it is, as the Buddha said, a raft. We have to take materials from this side, this shore of samsara, the shore of conditioned phenomena, because that's all we can reach. And then we use that for the purpose of going across. But obviously, whatever we use there from this shore is all conditioned. It's not what we're actually trying to get to, the unconditioned, but it's something that supports us and can be useful on the way to the unconditioned, to the other side. So someone thinks now they have the right interpretation of dependent origination, others have the wrong interpretation. Okay, if they have the right interpretation, then hopefully in their heart it will go into Nirodha. They will experience avijja, yatveva sesa viraga nirodha, sankhara nirodho, from the complete cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of all formations. Now, if one experiences that, then one's interpretation is fully in line. That's the purpose, that's the point. Okay, a few things that come to my mind, stimulated by a discussion we had yesterday on that, and by the sometimes very dogmatic and heated discussion on dependent origination. The people who experience the patiloma, going it all into a cessation mode in their heart, they tend not to argue much. It's very unconducive to arguing, to experience cessation in the heart. Yes. There's no, how to say, the Buddha uses different ones, and he sometimes introduces digressions, sometimes he introduces shortcuts. Very, very known as the 12 links. 12 links starting with ignorance, avijja. I didn't want to go for a whole kind of talk on dependent origination, where trying to explain through the links, and so I just went very quickly. So if you really wanted to do the intellectual investigation of that, which is obviously also useful. I'm not saying that don't try to intellectually understand that. That's obviously how it all starts. And it's good to refine one's intellectual and conceptual understanding of the Dhamma and make that more refined and more in line with what the Buddha intended. That's all beneficial and good. But that I wouldn't have enough time also for that, to go into that quite deeply. But you can find that in all the literature, the 12 links. On the other hand, sometimes the Buddha has the loop. It's quite intriguing when you first encounter that, coming from linear Western causality. It can be sometimes very almost agitating in the beginning. Sometimes it really drove me a little bit. What's going on here? And because the Buddha introduces these loops, so he goes back from suffering, and then he comes back to name and form, and the condition of name and form is consciousness. When you ask, what is the condition of consciousness, then it's name and form. So you end up with a loop, two sheaths of barley leaning against each other. But in other occasions, he goes back and then he says, what's the condition for consciousness? And then he says, sankhara's formations. And then you go back, and what is the cause for sankhara? Without what being there, would sankhara not be there? And then that is ignorance of avijja. Now then they ask Vanabhasaya, what is the cause for avijja? And then he says, it's the asavas, the corruptions. But one of the asavas is actually avijja asava. One of the asavas is actually ignorance. So you've got a partial loop. Now once the Buddha turns us back to a full loop, the six sense bases have as a condition name and form, the sentient body. Name and form has a condition consciousness, and consciousness has a condition name and form, so loop it. Then you go back further in a different explanation or in another occasion. Formations as a condition for consciousness and ignorance as a condition for formations. And then when Vasariputta is asked, and then he says, the corruptions are the condition for ignorance. But one of the three corruptions is actually ignorance. So then you've got a partial loop. The beginning was sometimes quite agitating for me. It's not quite how you usually operate in physics or in Western science. But it's fascinating, and sometimes the Buddha makes digressions. And then he goes externally, in the Mahanidana Sutta, he actually goes into a large external digression, going through different conditions for external strife and fighting and war and so on, coming from avariciousness and so on. Now that can all be done. The principle is important, and you can extend that. But the really important one is to experience the patiloma, that it all goes nirvana in your heart. So understanding dependent origination means understanding it in such a way that it achieves the intended purpose, that you let go of all the links. But that's the whole point. Everything is linked to dukkha in the end. And you don't want to be linked to dukkha. And this is why when the links are seen, then the heart can let go. In a sense, you can say the Four Noble Truths is a kind of shortcut. It goes back straight from dukkha to craving. Not discussing the normally mentioned intermediate factors of upadana, bhava, jati. Jati is included in, but they're not discussing upadana and bhava links, clinging and becoming. And my apologies, the way I was talking makes more sense for people when they're already familiar with dependent origination. But 5 to 5 now, I wouldn't be really able to give a long exposition. I wanted to make the main point that it's about experiencing the nirodha mode, the cessation mode, rather than building up a very strong doctrine based on one particular intellectual, conceptual interpretation of it. Yes?
When you say cessation of the heart, sometimes I have trouble with the term in the heart. Would it also be, say, cessation of experience?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I could also say cessation in the mind, because well, there's experience, and experience is in your mind. It's not in your toe or in this cupboard. No? Experience is in the mind, consciousness. And heart and mind can be sometimes used quite synonymously. I sometimes like heart more because, at least when I hear mind, I start associating it more with the brain and more intellectual thinking. Whereas heart, I associate a bit more also with the emotions and so on, feelings. But anyway, you could say either. No? But I think it's an important point to be aware no, that dependent origination describes something happening in your heart, no, in your mind, in your conscious experience. And this is where it ceases. But no, this is also the whole universe ceasing. Sometimes people have this naive reality view that this universe is out there existing in a very naive, direct way. And I'm in this universe, and if I now cease, or my mind or my consciousness sees this, then it looks a bit like you're missing out on the party. The universe is still there and you only somehow sees. But this is quite a misunderstanding. The cessation occurring there is also the cessation of the whole universe. Because the universe in the Noble One's discipline, the way the Buddha describes it, is the universe of your conscious experience. That is a universe, sights, sounds, and the corresponding internal organs. So the moment that all ceases, there is no more universe. There's no more party going on which you have now left and missed out. The whole universe is gone. Because the whole universe arises, so dependent origination describes the arising of your own conscious experience, but that is also the arising of the whole universe. So the universe kind of arises and ceases in your heart, in your mind. It's not something out there with an absolute, real, objective existence. Yes, yeah. Yeah, against the grain, the other direction. I think literally it means like when you have a cat and you can stalk the fur with the grain or against the grain. Even carpets and so on have that. It's exactly correct, yeah. We have to go against the stream of craving. We have to go into the normal thing is obviously the arising mode. This is usually what people experience, that all these things arise and grow, and like rivers filling up is sometimes a simile, rivers constantly filling up and getting more and all this water coming down. So similar in the whole dependent origination chain. This is why it's anuloma. At least for the beings who haven't freed their heart yet.
More like becoming a god of a truer life.
I certainly can't answer that from experience, but according to the teaching of the Buddha, to say that an Abhan after passing away doesn't exist would be wrong. However, to say that that person exists is also wrong, and that they neither exist nor not exist, or both exist and not exist, and they're all four wrong, because you try to proliferate something that is completely beyond proliferation. Just like one simile they were giving is like the great ocean, and now someone asking, how many buckets of water is a great ocean? And it's very difficult to try to explain that, although actually that simile doesn't work so well nowadays, because nowadays you could actually express it with reasonable accuracy in buckets. But in ancient India, when you stand at the ocean, there's obviously no way to somehow estimate even how many buckets of water that is. So similar, after the death of a person whose heart is completely freed, any of these four options of the tetralemma exist or doesn't exist, or both or neither, wouldn't apply. However, you don't even have to wait until they pass away. The same applies already while they are still alive, before their mind has gone beyond proliferation. And once you want to try to explain, so to speak, the mind of the Tathagata, you're already here now in that dilemma. You wouldn't be able to really explain that. But once the body and the five khandhas have ceased, then there's no more way how you can possibly express that. But also the whole universe is gone for that person. Because the universe is a subjective thing in the definition that the Buddha gives of the universe via the six senses. I think it's very important to keep that in mind. A lot of these doubts come from this perception that there's an objective, existing, external universe, a very naive view. Now, if I close my eyes, and the universe exists just like before. But you see the universe different. So if we both close our eyes, which universe is left? The one that looks like in your consciousness, or the one that looks like in my consciousness? That's probably still somewhat similar, but if a dog is also closing their eyes, and they have only black and white vision? What if a butterfly closes their eyes? They live in a much more, visually they see all this ultraviolet and so on that we can't see, and so on. You start, becomes a little bit tricky, which universe outside is a real one, yours or mine? So that definitely, clearly the teaching is that it's not just, you could ask the same question about the universe, the universe doesn't exist anymore, that also wouldn't apply. You're also operating with this whole Sakaya Ditti. For a person to exist, you need Sakaya Ditti, entity view, and ad upadana, and ideas and misconceptions of self and so on. Without that, this whole question will not really arise so much anyhow. There's only dukkha arising and dukkha passing away. I'm sure this hasn't cleared your doubts, but fully cleared, that can be only fully cleared from the experience of stream entry. You will already understand what that is from stream entry onwards, even if you haven't fully experienced it, but then you have gotten. Then we will have an idea, and once we can have the Dhammacakka arising, then you have an idea and what is a very clear understanding of what is the final goal. I have another one, okay.
Yeah, I had a question. How then was a high quality question? Because in asking the question itself, you're already, that's already indicating what the question is.
Yeah, the Buddha talked about how to deal with different forms of questions. And some questions have to be set aside. You cannot engage with them in any helpful way because they already include certain completely misleading, wrong underlying assumptions. That if you try to answer it in the way the question is framed, you're already on the completely wrong kind of ship, so to speak, and doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. That is, for example, is there a self? And the Buddha was once asked point blank, is there a self? And he actually refused to answer that because he felt that whatever you answer there, it will lead to misunderstandings. What he would say is that all formations are not self. All formations, all conditioned phenomena that you actually, all dhammas, even the unconditioned, will not have the qualities which we normally ascribe to a self on closer investigation. And all conditioned phenomena are also not worth holding on to, and self always implies a clinging, grasping. They go together. And as all conditioned phenomena are not worth holding on to, it's not a smart idea to regard them as safe. But if you come and ask in a point blank, is there a safe? No, then with that one, it will not really work. When you say there is not, then the person misunderstands that as annihilationism. When you say there is, they misunderstand it as eternalism. when you try to explain, it doesn't really work. So the Buddha, that one, he just didn't answer. And it's like if you ask someone,
for example, if someone asks who created this mountain over there, so it's already implies
implying that it's a who.
Well, it's actually just forming with some sort of geologic activity.
Exactly. Now the who is already, you cannot really answer that, and who created that. But you get an idea, and you're introducing a wrong, misleading thing embedded in the question. And then engaging with the question in a direct way means that you're already stuck in that wrong underlying assumption. Yeah. That's quite a good example.
Upasiva's questions are a nice answer to his question about the state of the Arahant after passing away.
And how did it go? Tangatasa napamanang ati yenanang vatru tangatasa nati samuateso sapesu damesu samuata vada padapi sape, something like
almost
that.
Yes, it was almost there. Yeah, so,
we can give the translation.
Just like a flame that is extinguished cannot be defined anymore, so too the silent sage who has liberated from the mind group reaches the goal, is beyond all words or beyond all designations. And then Upasiva asks the Buddha, does the one who has reached the goal exist, or does he not exist, or is he eternally free from affliction? To explain this, and the Buddha says, for the one who has reached the goal, there's no sort of limitation. Whatever one might say about him, he's not that. When all dhammas are uprooted, then all pathways of language are also uprooted.
Yeah. So someone who has reached the goal, that is nibbana, total freedom, they obviously have not transcended all sankha, all reckoning, all measuring. And if you try to put any designation on them, for example, exist or doesn't exist, no, it doesn't work, no, they're completely beyond that. Yeah.
The Buddha gives this nice dual similes of extinguished like a fire and immeasurable like the ocean. So, in terms of the defilements which are extinguished, and then the ocean which is immeasurable.
And it's quite important that you have the ocean simile, because unfortunately the concept of fire was very different in ancient India. And a simile uses usually something which is very obvious to explain something difficult and subtle. And for people in ancient India, it was obvious that flame gone out is not just into non-existence. They had a very different idea of fire. But they had the idea that fire is liberated from its fuel, which it is clinging to when it's extinguished. So nowadays that is usually misinterpreted. If you use a fire simile and you say the liberated person is like a flame gone out or like a lamp gone out, that is often misinterpreted as annihilationism. Another problem is if you're in a cold country, not so much Brisbane, but if you're like saying good old blighty England, you're sitting there in winter in front of a nice fireplace and warming up on the nice fire, and now I come in with a bucket of water, extinguish your fire. It's not a good simile for Nibbana. You're sitting there freezing, and in front of you, you have got this cold ashes, and it's actually cold. Whereas for Indians, the simile was more like that it's too hot anyhow, and then the fire going out has more positive connotations. But the most important one is that a fire gone out in our perception is simply non-existent. It's a simile for non-existence. And if I blow out that candle, then I ask you about that flame, you will just say it's just non-existent now. But for an ancient Indian, it wasn't quite like that. This is why it's very important to balance the simile nowadays with the one about the great ocean, because the great ocean is obviously not a very good simile for something non-existent, but something for something immeasurable and infathomable. Yeah, okay, we had a discussion on the subtle Dhamma here. Must be Tom Deepakur with bringing all the deep Dhamma here, or whatever, maybe the discussion yet yesterday, or maybe our diligent meditator living in the Dhamma hall. So my apologies if that didn't make too much sense for someone coming in more newly, but it's hopefully still stimulating and you'd like to start investigating now dependent origination, the tetralemma of neither existing nor not existing, nor both nor neither, and these kind of things. And you may investigate now whether there's really a objectively existing universe out there. Once you start going into that and it starts crumbling away, you will be surprised. We should maybe mention what we were trying to quote there. I think it was difficult for people to pick that up as a very profound and a subtle teaching in verses. And we were trying to quote that and translate that by heart. So that is in the Sutta Nipata, sometimes translated as Group of Discourses, one of the scriptures, the poetic books, Sutta Nipata. And it's the Parayana Vagga, the chapter on going to the further shore. And it's the end of Upasiva's question. And do you know the verse number? Of?
It's something like 1,100, maybe 1,090, something like this.
About verse number 1,090 in the Sutta Nipata, if anyone wants to check that. I think it was difficult for people to grasp that from us quickly trying to present that. That's a very worthwhile thing to look into, Sutta Nipata, Parayana Vagga, some very deep, profound Dhamma in there.